Hello, gang. This podcast is brought to you by swag.com, S-W-A-G. That's right. Those fun gifts that you like to send your customers and your employees. What's super cool about swag.com is that they're the first platform on the planet to have a turnkey software as a service solution for large companies. Their customers are Google, Facebook, Starbucks, Netflix, Amazon. You go kind of right down the list. And they're basically helping you manage your swag in a super efficient and a very elegant manner. What's particularly cool about swag.com is that they can manage your inventory for you. So you don't need to dig it out of your closet. They basically will store the inventory for you in one of their facilities, which are scattered around the country. And you just log into the portal. You can either make a new purchase or you can tell them to send some of your existing swag products to certain people. And you can send to one people or one person, or you can send to 20 or to 200. So it's a very cool platform that just kind of removes all of the messiness with picking, packing, and particularly shipping swag. I'll also mention that I'm an investor in the company because I like the product so much. There's no other solution out there that's so technology-driven and just solves so many problems in the very archaic, old-school world of swag. So they've offered a discount for friends of the podcast, and the discount code is simply BOB10. That's B-O-B-1-0. B-O-B-1-0, and you'll get a 10% discount using that on their website, which is swag.com, S-W-A-G.com. This podcast is also brought to you by All33's Backstrong Chair, which you've heard me talk about before, and apparently we are pushing a lot of product for them through the podcast. This is the best chair ever, and I do not say that lightly. The name comes from the fact that this is the first and only chair that allows for the movement of all 33 of the vertebrae in your spine while you sit. I have used fancy chairs over the years and not so fancy, and they all seem to disappoint in their own special way. And I'm sure you've experienced the same. Either the saddle feels good, but the arms don't, or the back doesn't move enough, or my legs start to lock up, and so on. I've been using the All 33 chair for just about a year, and it has completely removed my lower back pain and my general fatigue that I get when I sit too long. It's essentially slouch-proof. The saddle moves, which provides ergonomically correct support for the lower thoracic area and also promotes ideal posture. The saddle isn't fixed like most chairs, and instead it sort of moves in the same direction as your ball and hip joint. And of course, we all know that sitting is indeed the new smoking, and you need to sit correctly and need the right chair to do it for you. The folks at All33 have a $100 discount for friends of the podcast, and you can go to all33.com/discount/Bob to get that discount. Again, all33.com/discount/Bob.
Bob Johnston Podcast.
Hi, gang. It's probably safe to say that we've all had firsthand experience with telehealth over the past number of months. Even my old mom is an expert at Zooming with her doctor these days. And it brings up the question of where are we as a society with telehealth, which ailments are best suited for telehealth, etc. And as such, my guest today is Yulin Wong, who is a Teladoc Fellow and President of Teladoc's Healthcare Systems Group. He sold his company, which is called InTouch Health, to Teladoc in January of 2020, January of this year. So presuming they got some stock in that deal, I imagine he and his team are quite happy given the run-up in the Teladoc stock over the past number of months. Yulin has spent his entire career in healthcare technology and the past 20 years specifically focused on telehealth. He is also considered to be the father of surgical robots, having founded his first company in the mid-90s, squarely focused on surgical robots, and subsequently merged that with a company called Intuitive Surgical, which is now, of course, a very large publicly traded company. And we cover a lot of ground, ranging from Teladoc being at the center of massive transformation right now in healthcare, where they're headed next, the three biggest hurdles that telehealth is overcoming from the public view. We talk about his early days raising VC money for several companies and taking one of them public. And of course, we talk a little bit about surfing near his home in Santa Barbara as well. So I hope you enjoy this wide-ranging conversation. I had a lot of fun and I learned a lot as well. Enjoy. Lynn Wong, thank you for joining. And I thought we could jump right in and talk a little bit about the state of telehealth. We all, of course, know since March that this space is a complete juggernaut, and anything related to telehealth, whether it's a publicly traded stock or private investments or whatnot, have a lot of attention right now. What's your sense of, as a society, where we are in terms of the current state of telehealth? Do you think that things will look moving forward how they look now, in terms of access, in terms of the necessity of telehealth tools and that type of thing?
I think that in terms of the state of telehealth, so I've been involved in the field for 19 years, since 2001. And back at that point in time, you know, when you talked about telehealth, people thought you were a little bit crazy. Pre-pandemic, telehealth was already on a very nice trajectory, 30% growth-ish kind of trajectory, adoption happening very nicely and smoothly. And then the pandemic hit and it freaking hockey sticked it. I mean, it just went vertical in terms of adoption of telehealth, because it became the only way people could get their healthcare. If you think about, so where are we in the whole evolution of virtual care and telehealth? If you think of a scale from 1 to 10, let's say pre-pandemic, we were on a 2 to 3, maybe it jumped to 5 to 6, but there's still a long ways to go to get telehealth or virtual care systemically integrated into the healthcare system. But it's clearly going to keep moving forward as opposed to post-pandemic going backwards. I don't think that's going to happen.
Yeah. When you think about, you know, certain types of doctor's visits, it seems to me that some are quite suitable for telehealth, and then there's others you've got to use your imagination, you know, a little bit. Where do you think we land on all that? For example, skin doctor, right? I mean, I suppose you could hold your camera up to your head or your skin, you know, your arms, your legs, and say, look, you know, I've got a splotch here, but it'd be pretty hard to assess that without touching it and seeing it. So I guess, you know, where do you think we land on all that?
Well, so just since you brought up a skin doctor or dermatologist, quite honestly, that is one of the very good uses of telehealth. And a lot of people are doing that. And one of the real advantages of telehealth in dermatology is you can take a picture, you can send it to your dermatologist. It can become what's called asynchronous. And then the a doctor gets back to you when they have time, as opposed to needing to sync up in time, which makes things more constraining. You know, I think the evolution of telehealth and where the line becomes, you can use kind of banking as an analogy. A banking, you know, go back 20, 30 years, everybody went into the banks to do all their transactions. Now, 90%+ of the transactions we do with our banks are done online and remotely. But there are certain things you need to do at the bank, sign major documents or papers or financings. You have to still go into the bank. Surgery, for example, in telehealth is going to stay in the hospital for as long as I know. Certain things will have to stay in the hospital. If you do an MRI or CT scan, requires big, expensive equipment. You need to kind of put it together in a central location like a hospital, ICUs, et cetera. Where does that, if you take 100% of patient care, does 50% of it become virtualized? Does 60% of it become virtualized? I don't know, but I think it's in that range. You know, you can do very complex things via telehealth. What we do at Teladoc is, so stroke, you know, stroke is a big deal. I mean, people die, live and die based on stroke assessment. We'll do a couple hundred thousand strokes a year right now in terms of taking care of stroked patients. We do surgical mentoring. In other words, a remote surgeon helps another surgeon to safely walk through a new procedure. We do neonatal resuscitation, which is like a newborn baby comes out, they're not breathing, having a remote neonatologist make sure that baby comes alive well is something we do. So we do that all the way down to the low acuity spectrums of sneezes and sniffles and flus and stuff like that. So you can do a lot with telehealth. It won't be 100%, but you can do quite a bit.
When did you sell your company to Teladoc?
Why?
When?
It was announced in January of 2020. It closed on July 1st of 2020.
Oh, okay. Interesting. Yeah. So that was quite an interesting time, I guess, to make the acquisition in the midst of all this.
Yes.
And are you guys in terms of the branding, are you standalone or are you considered part of their brand? Are they kind of rolling you under, or is that all kind of TBD?
No. So Teladoc Health, which until recently only publicly traded company, definitely right. The largest telehealth company, their customers historically pre-InTouch Health were to the health plans and to the employers.
Yeah.
InTouch was the dominant telehealth provider to health systems like hospitals. And so the reason for the marriage, and it made a lot of sense, is by combining InTouch with Teladoc, we now have the market leading position of providing telehealth services to health plans, employers, and health systems.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. And did you bring your whole team there? And is everybody really jazzed up? I mean, you know, the Livongo deal has also happened right now. I mean, it's just got to be a rocket ship over there.
Yeah, I think.
And I imagine there's just a ton of energy, right? It's what's it like on the inside of the organization right now?
You know, there aren't many times, if ever, you get to be at the center of really a movement of a massive industry like healthcare.
Yeah, I mean, yeah.
Digital health, telehealth, virtual care is really the center right now of healthcare transformation. And so it's very, very exciting to be here. I didn't finish on the last point. So InTouch Health now operates as the healthcare system division of
Gotcha.
We're called HHS.
Okay. So then you now are Teladoc branded HHS.
Correct.
Gotcha. Okay. That's good to know. And then, in terms of, you know, the Livongo deal, I mean, I guess, you know, these guys are on a tear, you know, at Teladoc.
Yeah. I mean, Teladoc is, you know, going for the brass ring of being the dominant digital health company. So it's broader than telehealth. It's kind of broader than just virtual care. It's actually kind of this umbrella of digital health.
Yeah. Yeah. Where did they, that stock, I remember as recently as 36 months ago, you know, the stock was maybe 15 or 16 bucks and it's just been cranking now, you know, with the Livongo deal, a little bit of a dip, but you know, I think the analysts probably read that wrong in the first week, you know, and they've realized that, but, where do you think, like, when you mentioned this whole, you know, not just telehealth, what other aspects of digital health are there that you guys want to tackle? You know, And maybe there's some things you're able to discuss and you're not able to discuss, but I'm curious generally, like in the genre of digital health, what else is out there that can be grabbed?
Yeah, and there's a lot of, you know, little pieces and different capabilities and all. But I think that the idea is that when healthcare can be delivered digitally, you know, whether it's through a digital person who's virtually present or digitally, as in you have the ability to have the computer systems themselves, whether they're chatbots or some kind of AI-driven engine, help in the ongoing management of healthcare for patients. I think that's digital health. And when you're really thinking about the longitudinal perspective of a patient or a consumer, that's really what digital health's all about. And I think to your point about Livongo, you know, obviously the deal was under wraps and for obvious reasons until it was announced. And it, you know, to my understanding, it, you know, takes explaining to understand, because it's really kind of forward thinking in terms of why it makes a lot of sense for the two organizations to come together. And I think that, you know, that's clearly being slowly but surely understood by the marketplace.
Yeah. I think you're right too. And, you know, like I said, sometimes the analysts aren't looking beyond a quarter. So it's when you see a stock price dip quickly, that's usually the reason, where one or two analysts may have come out with a report, you know, and all the shaky hands in the market, you know, are selling. But I think when you look at the massive opportunity for the brand, I mean, you already have a massive lion's share of the market, and there's a lot more to grab over the next 10 years.
Mm-hmm. If you think of, you know, what I was saying earlier, and I was speaking specifically about telehealth, but think of it broadly in digital health. If you think, you know, 60 to 70% of healthcare can be delivered digitally, and that means with or without a person, and we have a $3 trillion industry, it's big. And that was just domestic level wide.
Yeah. So. Yeah. Can we talk a little bit about the boomers? Because I look at the boomers as, you know, they're such a massive slice of the economy at the moment. A lot of them are retiring. We have all these pills now, and we've got protocols for longevity. So even if you have an ailment, you know, you may live a heck of a lot longer than you think you might. And so when you look at the stress on the healthcare system, what's your thinking around, you know, helping to solve issues like social determinants of health, loneliness and isolation? You know, these are real issues when you're in, you know, your 70s and your 80s, and you may have lost a partner. Can this type of challenge be solved with digital health?
So, you know, it's to speak specifically to the issues around, say, loneliness and social determinants of health. I mean, one of the areas that this country has awoken to is the huge challenge in issues around mental health. And mental health, as it turns out, is one of those use cases which could potentially even be superiorly delivered virtually as opposed to in person. In fact, the Teladoc has a significant presence in the mental health area, delivery of care, and as InTouch did prior to becoming part of Teladoc as well. And the interesting thing is, you know, I think a lot of people find that they're better able to converse with a remote clinician than sitting in a couch in the same office, and also can work, you know, can sit in their own, in the comfort of their own home, because they're often sharing their deepest secrets. And so mental health, I think, is one of those things which can very, very, very much be helped through the virtual care delivery mechanism. when you talk about social determinants of health in general, and you think about Livongo joining Teladoc and coming together, where they their focus has been on chronic diseases like diabetes, hypertension, obesity, and then they have this technology, they call it AI plus AI, to give nudges to patients or people to improve just how they take care of themselves to keep them healthier and lower their total costs. I think that's also impacting this area, which you're calling social determinants of health. I think the big thing which we have to be very concerned about with the boomers all aging is just the total cost of the healthcare system. I mean, in about 1900, the average life expectancy was about 40-ish. You know, about now, it's call it in the mid-70s or even broaching 80, and depending upon where you live in the world and gender. I mean, it's almost a doubling of the average life expectancy in 120, 130 years. It's actually phenomenal progress created by actually improved technology, medical technology, et cetera. As the boomers age up and the traditional pyramid of population distribution shifts into an inverse pyramid, we have to do things like digital health in order to make a health system which can provide high quality care, but do so at a much lower cost. Because even with the same population and you shift the population to have a much higher percentage older, you actually add a lot more cost burden on the healthcare system, because older people consume more healthcare dollars than young people.
Yeah.
That's another, I think, incredibly compelling reason why digital health has to be adopted broadly and systemically.
Can you speak to what's going on the regulatory front?
Okay. So in terms on the regulatory front on telehealth, you know, the things which have really held it back are regulatory barriers, reimbursement, and just culture.
Yeah.
So
I guess when you look at culture, you're referring to the culture of perhaps older school thinking on the political front.
The
government side.
The health systems too.
Yeah.
Where patients come to the health system as opposed to the health system and healthcare going to the patient. Doctors, they have their office and patients come and they wait for, half an hour to hour and a half for a 3-minute visit. And they come in one after another, like that is the way it's been done for a long time. And it's incredibly inconvenient for patients, but it's very optimized for the clinician in terms of their efficiency.
Yeah.
The pandemic changed that culture very, very quickly, because the clinicians themselves needed to stay safe and to not be exposed to the virus. I think and that brought about massive regulatory and reimbursement changes, which had been moving along at a nice pace, but then all of a sudden, the barriers were lifted and incentivized dramatically. For example, the regulatory side, the whole, even for a period of time, state licensures were suspended by the federal government. The state had its own say about things. The issues around HIPAA and PHI were actually temporarily suspended, which you would never think would happen, but it's done so in light of the pandemic. But then, you had regulatory barriers around anti-kickback and Stark laws, which were slowing down telehealth propagation and adoption. And then reimbursement. It used to be telehealth was only reimbursed if the patient was in a rural setting, which then became a smaller fraction of someone's total book of business where it didn't even make sense. And so why should I do something with someone rural and not get paid when if they just come to my office, I'll get paid. And so reimbursements have all kind of been put in place now. And those are probably staying to what level, don't really know. But reimbursement and regulatory barriers are no longer huge issues.
What is perhaps the single largest obstacle right now? It sounds like it's not regulatory. Perhaps it's just older school thinking with some of the constituents.
If you had asked me what's the biggest barrier, you know, pre-pandemic, I would have said regulatory reimbursement. Yeah. But you're asking that question right now. Yeah. And what the biggest barrier is the adaptation of the health systems and the healthcare system to adjust to work in this new manner. So, I mean, let's get it all the way down to the independent physician level. How do I visit my patients when they're at home? How do I visit them when in the hospital? When do I visit a patient in person? When do I visit at home? How do you schedule those things? It's basically a total change of workflow. I mean, imagine banking if you went from everybody going into the bank to all of a sudden the way banking is today and how you had to change your mindset so quickly. That's kind of what's going on right now.
So it sort of sounds like maybe the silver lining with the pandemic is that the regulatory and, you know, the reimbursement piece, there's been maybe 6 years of progress in the past 6 months. And
that's exactly right.
I suppose that's a wonderful thing for folks that are in your position.
Yes. Yes.
Yeah. Yeah.
That Abraham Lincoln said, luck is when preparation meets up with opportunity. And
yeah.
We worked pretty long for a long period of time to be prepared, but then the opportunity came along.
So switching gears a little bit, you are considered the founding father, if you will, of surgical robotics. Can you talk a little bit about your work there and particularly where you think we're headed next? I mean, I read all kinds of articles on this stuff and, you know, the notion of miniature robots running through your bloodstream, cleaning viruses out of your body and cancers and so forth. I mean, you know, where are we in terms of that becoming a reality?
So surgical robots, I started a company in 1990 called Computer Motion and went public in 97, merged with Intuitive Surgical in 2003, which makes the Da Vinci surgical robot, which is, the dominant surgical robot used around the world. And what's so interesting about, and I'm actually still very close with the people there, the future of surgical robots is really not so much in the robot themselves, it's in the computational algorithms which drive them. So, you know, so I guess you mentioned many types of robots per se, whether they're miniature bots or nanobots or things like that. Those, you know, people are working on, I don't know where they are in advanced development. What is clearly in commercial and clinical use and continuing to move forward are robots which are used as surgical tools to perform less invasive surgery. And that's still got a lot of advancement to go. And that's going to be very, very exciting, where you can, you know, do things like combine image processing techniques with the robot in order to make sure a surgeon doesn't sever a nerve or an artery that shouldn't happen, using forms of artificial intelligence in order to help improve the skill set of the surgeon in terms of, you know, should they be doing step 1, 2, 3 or 1, 3, 2 and things like that. So I guess that, so that kind of surgical robot is going to keep advancing nicely, and it's going to be doing more and more so that if a patient does need surgery, a higher and higher percentage of those people will have their operation done with the assistance of a surgical robot. If you go into some of these, you know, more advanced things, like you were talking about, you know, microbots, nanobots, et cetera, I can't speak very intelligently to. There are some significant challenges in terms of, you know, things like power, things like, use cases as well. A lot of these small things are now being worked on more in the form of catheters, like putting robotic capabilities on the end of catheters as opposed to little autonomous guys. And so that's how I see probably, at least in the nearer term horizon, how miniaturized bots get placed into the body.
Gotcha. That makes sense. And I guess it's probable then that the machine learning will drive more innovation in maybe the balance of machine versus man with certain surgeries could tip a little, but it sounds like we're still quite far off from, you know, true kind of nanobots, you know, running around your body and fixing things.
I think that's true. I think we're pretty far off from that. So you're combining two things. One is the size and shape of the surgical robot, and one is the autonomy by which it works. And I think the autonomy by which it works on the more macro scale surgical robots, but maybe having very small end effectors, maybe catheter based, I think that is definitely moving down a good continuum where AI techniques can be helping to do more autonomously and improve the skills of the surgeon.
Yeah.
I think the nanobot thing is the one where I'm not sure how soon that's going to be real.
Yeah. Switching gears a little bit to your background. So I guess at what point in time did you realize you wanted to be a founder of a business? It sort of looks like you were down that path, you know, the medical path, right? So I guess what changed for you, or were you a born entrepreneur? Maybe you were born entrepreneur.
No, so my father was a professor. I did my PhD in electrical and computer engineering, specializing in robotics at the University of California at Santa Barbara. And then I hit that fork in the road of going academics or not. I wanted to invent new products. That's what I, for whatever reason, was passionate about. And I fortunately was able to do that in an entrepreneurial way, as opposed to joining a big company and doing it that way.
Yeah. Gotcha. And when you were launching your first business, which I guess was 1990, right? What was the environment like raising money? And, you know, you look at the sizes of rounds now, you know, your classic seed round nowadays looks like the size of a Series A or B round, you know,
right. Yeah.
30 years ago. What was it like then? Were the conversations with investors, you know, similar to what they are nowadays? Was there a little more runway with revenue, or was it still kind of, you know, the balls to the walls method view, you know, that VCs seem to have nowadays, where they're, you know, they're trying to find the unicorn, right?
Yeah. I think the commonality between then and now is it's always hard to raise money. And, you know, when I started my career, one of my mentors taught me there's actually not a shortage of money out there, but there's no shortage of good ideas.
Yeah.
So the bridge is confidence. That's actually what makes money flow into ideas. And if you're working on something which is kind of out there, like surgical robots at that time, or telemedicine in the early 2000s, it was hard to bridge that confidence. So that's been my experience. Mm. I think that when you did raise money, like in the 90s, you know, the A rounds were 3 million or 5 million. A big round was 10. When we went public in 97, we raised 40 million. And that was a very nice, solid IPO.
Yeah.
At that time. And as you were articulating, you know, today A rounds can be 10 to 30 million, B's can be 30 to 50, and the investors are looking for the unicorn, which is kind of what makes things very difficult to raise money at, because you're really threading the needle pretty tight.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, it's interesting. On one hand, it's probably a good barrier to entry, in the sense that if you want to raise institutional money, you're going to have to make sure that you've got something that a VC fund feels will move the needle for them. On the other hand, moving a VC fund's needle means that you're on a timeline where you've got to have an exit in, let's call it 5 to 7 years, and that may not meet the timeline of the founders. You know,
yeah, I think that my understanding, and I'm not current on the literature on this, I think that over the last decade or so, the investment horizon on average has become longer.
Yeah.
And so you know, the money's larger, kind of going in, the investment horizons are longer. So I think that's, you know, just what the institutional investors, the VCs, have to consider and live with. One of the things I've learned over the last 30 years, though, is there are different ways to raise money. You don't need to only think of venture capital. There's so many different segments of types of money, and it's sometimes, but it's not easy to find avenues into the different segments of money. Like, you know, one of the big growing areas supposedly is family offices.
Family. Yeah. I was going to say that. Yeah. There seems to be a lot of activity there.
Right.
And, it could be that, that the family offices aren't going to beat you up quite as much on valuation, and they may have a longer time horizon, just as you mentioned earlier.
That's right.
Yeah.
Yeah. The challenge is, will they lead? Because often they'll want to put themselves behind an institutional venture capital.
Yeah. Yeah. We've seen, and we have a small fund here, and we've seen that, you know, the family offices typically aren't going to lead, with the exception of one recent transaction, but that was not a seed round. You know, it was a bit of a later round where a lot of the risk, you know, was already mitigated in the business.
Yeah.
Yeah. Are you investing at all as a private investor?
I do. I have been for many years, and I just do little, you know, small personal investments.
Excellent.
Yeah.
Excellent. Great. What else do I want to ask you on the entrepreneurial front? So that was your first business. Okay. And then your second business, when you were raising money for that, that was 2006, right?
My first raised the money in 2003.
Okay. Gotcha.
Yeah.
And when you were raising money for that business, was it sort of a similar kind of conversation, or was it like, oh, this guy's already done it and he's already IPO'd a company and it's going to be a lot easier to raise money?
It was. Yeah.
Yeah.
I think that, yeah, it was definitely much easier to raise money than the first time around. The unfortunate thing, I've hit the age where it's too late for me to do a third one, because it would be potentially even, I think it'd be even easier now.
Even easier now, right?
I don't want to anymore.
You never know. Right. You know, the long days, right? Working 24/7, you don't have to do that anymore if you don't want to. So that might be a good segue to the next question, which is, if you were 25 again, and you were kind of looking out into the world, and you're seeing a lot of interesting activity in biotech and healthcare, you know, and so forth, what what advice might you give someone in those shoes as to either an industry that they could focus on and latch on to a mentor, perhaps if they want to go the corporate route, types of companies or industries they might be looking at? What's your sense of, you know, the next, you know, let's call it, you know, like the next 20 to 30 years, you know, if you're 25 years old and you want to stake your bet on a career, where would you go?
You know, so I have four kids, three are through college and one's in college. And so this is, I think about that question a fair amount because I have my own kids. At the highest level, I try to think of, hey, you know, you skate to where the puck's going, right? I personally think that's the exciting place to be. And so you should think about your career from that perspective. If you want to get into, you know, the specifics, my whole career has been healthcare technology and I've loved it. And I think that's still and a very vibrant area for the decades to come because of many of the questions you've already asked, the aging boomers, you know, where people need healthcare, et cetera, et cetera. So I think that that's, and then if you get down into the healthcare technology, one level layer. So digital health, I think, is going to be huge. And I think there's still a huge future for it. I'm personally working a lot on the intersection of AI and virtual care. And that, I think, is a very exciting area, which I think is going to be going for a while. I'm no expert in understanding all the stuff going on in genomics and proteomics and those types of areas, but those appear to have very exciting areas. I personally think where the puck's going is often the convergence of two or more areas which have been separate but are coming together. Like surgical robots is, you know, robots had been going for decades beforehand. Mm-hmm. Then their surgery became minimally invasive, and then it created the opportunity for surgical robots to come together. Telemedicine, the internet came around, the advancement of technologies like robots and sensors and cell phones. It's the convergence which kind of created these new opportunities. So that's all healthcare, but there's obviously areas outside of healthcare, the areas of renewable energy, transportation. Those are going to be very exciting areas as well. So yeah. If I was a 25-year-old and given them, or if I was given a 25-year-old advice, I'd first of all say, what are you passionate about? And then figure out where you think the puck's going in an area you're excited about and head down.
And it's probably good if you have four kids, because if you give them the right advice, when they're 35, they're not going to be knocking on your door, you know? Dad, I need a little extra money for the mortgage. Right.
Exactly.
Yes. Well, so we have a couple of questions that we'd like to wrap up with, and one of which is, what is a contrarian view that you hold, which you are 100% convinced is true? And it could be light or heavy. It could be healthcare related. It could be sports related, right? It could be anything that's on your mind.
Well, you know, I'll tell you the one thing which I've been thinking about along those lines. Is, and this, you know, may not bode well with the audience, but I'll say it anyway, is the impact of social media. I think I've kind of gone through the cycle that others have gone through as well, where at first I thought it was great in bringing people together, people from all over the place, but I'm not sure how it exists today. If the challenges don't outweigh the benefits. And so that, I think, is a societal problem, which we have to fix somehow. Yeah. So I don't know.
Yeah. Well, I would second your opinion on that. Actually, we have been around for 20 years and we have almost exclusively marketed ourselves with email. It's only been the past month or month and a half that we have decided to turn on Twitter carefully and LinkedIn and so forth. And it's an experiment for us. And it's partially that I've seen, just as you say, a lot of other folks just sort of ride that wave and spend a lot of time and resources. And it's sort of unclear what the benefit is. Then on the personal side, right, it's even more challenging. You've got kids or, you know, everybody's presenting their best perfect self, you know, on Twitter, you know, and TikTok and so forth, and Instagram. And it's, and that feels to me not to be healthy.
I agree. And I think people would agree with the statement that, you know, the country has never been so divided and so divisive. And and it's, I think social media plays a role in that.
So
I don't know how to fix it, but I certainly think that energy should be put into fixing that.
Yeah. Or just have a commitment to, you know, really high quality content and posts, which of course is difficult, but
right.
You know, I mean, if you're a business, you can mandate that. If you're a citizen, you know, you don't have to.
Right. Right.
So the last question is what's on your browser in terms of maybe work related types of websites, and then anything on, you know, the personal side, whether maybe you're a surfer up there, you know, in Santa Barbara.
I am.
Whatever you are.
Is that
okay.
The picture you're seeing, kind of.
You know, I can see the I can see about the bottom half of it, but yeah.
So on the personal, I love watching surfing videos. And I surf a fair amount, and I play tennis. Those are kind of my two things, and so I watch the highlights of tennis matches, and I love watching good surf rides.
Yeah.
And then I try to stay pretty contemporary on current events. And I do that by just kind of going across the different news outlets. And I try to balance myself by looking at, you know, news outlets of the different political views in order to try to get some of a balanced perspective. I don't know how successful I am, but. That's what I do.
Yeah, and that makes sense. You know, we asked this question of almost all of the guests here, you know, and they range from CEOs of sports teams, you know, to folks like yourself, you know, and VCs and so forth. And almost exclusively, they say the same thing. They say, look, you know, each day I'm reading to get different views and I'm able to form my own opinion. And I think that's better than just saying, I only think one way and I'm going to wake up in the morning and I'm going to go to CNN only or to Fox only.
Right.
You know, or to this or that. Maybe that's one of the good things with Twitter is that there are differing views. And it's not a bad place to kind of, you know, scope out different perspectives. Mm-hmm. I wouldn't suggest that should be your primary source of information, however. But yeah.
Yeah. You know, I guess. The one thing about Twitter is it people need to abbreviate so much that you lose the finesse of being appropriate in how you convey your message and information, in my opinion. And so that's
well said. Yeah. So. Well said for sure. Well, I appreciate you joining, and this was a wonderful chat, and that is a wrap indeed. So, thank you for joining. And
it's my pleasure, and it's an honor to be part of this. Thanks for having me.